Welcome to The Milk Check, a podcast from TC Jacoby & Company, where we share market insights and analysis with dairy farmers in mind.
Hi, this is Ted Jacoby. I'm joined, as usual, by my father and Anna Donzi. And today we're also joined by Don Street and Diego Carvalho from our milk powder team, who handle the majority of the exports for TC Jacoby & Company, as well as Jacob Mensch from our risk management team. And we start by asking the question, will U.S. dairy exports be able to grow fast enough over the next 5 years to sustain a 2% milk production increase? Because if we continue to grow milk production at a 2% clip, we're going to have to continue to grow dairy exports at a record clip. Now, the truth is, we never end up answering the question specifically, but we go off on a tangent that ends up in a very interesting place. As usual, this podcast is about food for thought. And this is a question of whether or not the dairy industry in the United States is set up properly, structurally, to encourage exports. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Thanks.
I was reading Matt Gould's Dairy Market Analyst over the weekend, and he mentions at the beginning of his write-up that cheese sales, that the price of cheese is weak, and one of the factors that is contributing to weak cheese prices is weak exports. And then later on in the letter, he mentions that June exports as a percentage of milk solids is 8.1%, and I did some research. And in April and May, it was 8.9%. And so the Q2 average as a percentage of total milk production, we exported 18.6% of our milk solids, which I believe is a quarterly record for the largest percentage of milk solids we've ever exported. And so it just occurs to me that there's a real disconnect right now between what we're hearing in a lot of places that we need to export more in order to get prices up. And at the same time, we're exporting more milk solids than we ever have. And so it would lead to a really good discussion about what's really the issue here. If we're going to continue to have 2% milk production growth, and milk production growth continues to look strong, it means we're going to have to export a larger and larger percentage of the milk solids that we're creating in this country. And the question is the export market capable of handling and taking on that additional volume? And I think even more importantly, is it capable of handling that additional volume at decent milk prices? Because it's one thing to say, hey, we're going to export a ton of milk powder and we're going to do it at $1 a pound. It's another thing to do it at a price like $1.28, $1.29 like we are today, or even $1.50. And I don't think most dairy farmers are really interested in massive increases in export volume if we're doing it at super low milk prices, because that really doesn't add to profitability. So we've invited Don Street, who's head of our powder group, who handles the majority of the exports for our company, as well as Diego Carvalho. And then also joining us today is Jacob Mensch, who manages the risk management for the company and usually has some great insights on markets, as well as the usual suspects, myself, my dad, and Anna Donzi. Well, why don't we start there? So do you think CWT, Don, is inhibiting us from growing our dairy exports?
I don't think it helps, because it limits who can sell. And it also says to the buyer, well, I'll let you know as soon as I get somebody else's approval to make the transaction. And it takes away any desired focus on what the market price is. So I'm not a fan of CWT at all. And I think politically that's a difficult thing to say in this industry, but long term it just hurts far more than it helps.
I'd like to interrogate that a little bit. Why do you think it hurts, Don?
Well, because if we believe in market and price discovery, it's a distortion to the price discovery and it's a delay in confirming business. Markets should reflect demand. And so now you've put in another layer that something other than demand. It's more like wishful thinking to cloud up the price negotiation process.
Okay, I see your point, and I think it's a very good point. But right now, we're sitting at 18%, less rough numbers, of the industry's disappearance in the export market. And we're lamenting the fact that production is up from an average of maybe 1.5 to 1.9 per year up to 3 and 4 in some months. Where would we go? What would happen if we didn't have the export markets as part of our disappearance on the dairy industry?
Go on, Don.
I was just going to say the CWT piece is first cheese, second butter, and or whole milk powder. And the two biggest categories of exports, which are whey derivatives and skim milk powder, have no CWT at all, and they're functioning just fine. So why would you add that to products that you really want to grow in the future, butter aside, because like, we can talk about that later. But if cheese exports are supposed to grow and everybody wants them to, I still think it just clouds the whole transaction process and expectations of the buyer.
Well, cheese makes up 50%+ of our production right now, our disappearance right now. And yeah, we all want cheese to grow, but why would CWT inhibit growth?
Well, and again, it's a bit of a philosophical argument, but if you as a seller can't do firm business, but always has to be conditioned on CWT approval, well, I think that undermines your credibility to start with, and it delays the process of getting the buyers to focus on what the market is, because they can always say, let's see if CWT is higher next week. And it's not the market that's driving their decision. It's a third party's willingness to sweeten the deal.
You know, Don, just adding on to that really quick, from a just pure book economics perspective, it's preventing the domestic market and the international market from reaching a true equilibrium. And if that were to happen, I mean, I think you could argue that it really wouldn't happen with cheese, but if that were to happen, your transaction efficiency just goes to basically be perfectly efficient. And that would be very good for doing export business. So really, the person that's hurt, you could argue, by CWT is the domestic consumer, because ultimately their price is marginally higher because the exports are being subsidized. It just muddies the water. It makes your very simple supply and demand be a wrench thrown in there. So I see what Don's driving at.
You know, the export market is based on, Don, you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's based basically on the futures market. At least it has been in the past for cheese, CWT notwithstanding. But there's quite a juxtaposition in the futures market and the cash market. How does that square with the influence of CWT? And what would happen to the futures market if CWT were gone?
My gut is that the sellers today are using the futures markets anyway, because you can't sell product for shipment tomorrow. It's always 1 to 2 to 3 or 4 months into the future. So the futures markets are still being used by the seller, but I think that the buyer has a disincentive or to even look at that or to understand why or where a product is being priced like it is or would be without CWT. Because it's more the game of, oh, maybe CWT provides more funding per ton next week.
Jake, my question would be this. Do you think that the fact that we export most of our cheese based on a futures price in an environment like we have today, where there's arbitrage in the market, do you think that ultimately helps the dairy farmer in terms of the Class 3 milk price, or hurt the dairy farmer? And is it maybe a different issue short-term and long-term? Does my question make sense?
Yeah, a bit. I don't know that it actually matters. Rather, it's just kind of a function of the market. And commodity markets as a whole tend to have carry in the market. And if you have some extremes between the current cash market and nearby futures, I mean, that might impact exports in the short term, but in the long term, think the carry is just kind of a function of commodity markets and probably doesn't make much of an impact.
So even though, for example, the current spot market, cash market for blocks is $1.66, and if we wanted to go out and try and export cheese in the fourth quarter, we'd pay more like $1.79, $1.80. And that 14 cents may price us out of sales in the future. But what it does do is it basically builds inventory, which we got to eventually move anyway. And so it ultimately comes out in the wash.
If you believe the market's efficient, yes. Which I think for this discussion, we're just saying the market's efficient. Yeah, it's all going to clear eventually.
Dad, does that make sense to you?
Well, I'm digesting it. We have sufficient carry in cheese, but we don't have it in powder. Jake, is that a correct statement?
Yeah, there is basically no carrying powder. That is true.
And that has affected the margins on powder to the point where it's extremely difficult to actually buy and arbitrage future powder sales. So compare that to cheese, where we actually do have a carry and arbitrage, where you can take a position and incur less risk, let's say. It's hard for me to see how the CWT program interferes with that mechanic.
So I would argue this. What the non-fat market is currently telling manufacturers is go ahead and be aggressive in the future, 3 months from now, 6 months from now. Make deals today to export powder 6 months from now. The market is basically telling the manufacturers, be aggressive, make the sale. Simultaneously, the market is telling cheddar cheese manufacturers, the domestic market may need this product in the future. You should put it in a warehouse and hedge it out and wait to see if you really need it in 3 to 4 months. And CWT, which is available year round, and so it's basically how CWT affects the futures market and the cash market, I would argue, is baked in. It's already a part of the math that ends up calculating price. And so I would say that the futures market and the relationship between the futures market and the cash market in cheese is telling the market, don't be aggressive exporting that cheese. Now, you and I can sit here and argue whether we believe that's what the market should be telling the manufacturers. But essentially, that's what it is telling the manufacturers. Does that make sense?
It sounds a little bit hypothetical. I think we need to acknowledge that export sales are usually months in advance, and therefore the futures market is what prevails. So you're not going to get a CWT bonus on sales right now in November and December of this year. So really, it has no bearing on it. And as Don said, well, that causes everybody to sit around and wait, figuring maybe it will if they wait long enough. And yeah, to that extent, I have to agree with Don's point that it muddies the water with regard to determination of what market values are.
I don't want to get too in the weeds on it, but we're not really disagreeing here. We're just taking it one step further. So you're saying the export deals are based on the futures, let's just say in Q1 right now. But those futures in Q1, there is a relationship there with what the market is doing today, right? And that's where Ted's going in saying if there's an aggressive carry, it's implying that the domestic market is expecting big demand in Q1. And if there's a flat market, more or less like we're seeing in non-fat, you know, there's a penny a month carry, probably break even. It's saying, you know, hey, if you can get the export deal done, do it. We're not going to pay you, we being the futures market, we're not going to pay you enough to just sit on this inventory. So we're really not disagreeing. We're just taking the concept one step further, I would say.
And to be clear, I also agree with Don. CWT makes the market inefficient. It ends up having an effect, in my opinion, on the arbitrage. Because the arbitrage, I'm not sure how big an effect, but it probably has an effect on how much higher futures markets are 4 or 5 months forward relative to the cash price today, because they know that export deals will be discounted by CWT.
I think that's probably right, Ted, even though my premise was more of clouding or distorting the view of the buyer in this whole transaction process. but I take your point as well.
You know, I think the U.S. dairy market is in a different position internationally when it comes to cheese than it is when it comes to non-fat dry milk or many of the whey products. Non-fat dry milk, we export over 50% of the powder we make. Our domestic price for powder is really fully dependent on what the international market for powder is. I think that's true in non-fat. I think that's true in whey. I think that's true in lactose, whey permeate. All of those markets are very global. But with cheese, we still export only about 5% of all the cheese we make. You can have a hiccup in the domestic market, and the domestic market is such a larger percentage of the total market that it's been very difficult for cheese manufacturers to be present in the international market 12 months a year. And I actually think that is having a big effect on the volume of exports that we're making in cheese. The thing that I'm really curious about that I'm going to be watching closely in the next, let's say, next 5 years, is if we continue to grow our milk supply, and cheese production's up 5% year over year right now, if we continue to grow our cheese production the way we are, we're going to have to export a lot more of that cheese. Will we be able to become a consistent exporter of cheese in the world market, or will we continue to struggle there because it's such a small percentage of our total production? I don't know the answer to that.
I think the answer is very different for 2 years versus 5 years, personally. You know, especially 1 to 2 years, there's a lot of short-term headwinds that we need to get through.
Like what, Jake?
I think top of everyone's mind is just the logistics situation right now, and that is such a burden to the export market today.
You think it's safe to assume that this problem goes away in 2 years, or could this be a long-term problem?
Yeah, I think it goes away at some point, whether it be 6 months, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. You know, I was reading the Logistics Managers Index. They take a survey of a lot of big name people in the logistics world. And it basically measures whether just logistics, that's kind of everything, inventory levels. And this is not just for dairy or commodities. This is for across the economy. But it measures inventory levels, inventory costs, warehouse utilization, everything. And everything I just mentioned, inventory levels, inventory costs, warehouse utilization, warehouse prices, and transportation prices, all of those are growing. They're increasing. So the costs for warehousing are increasing. The inventory levels are increasing. And the only thing on the list that's contracting is transportation capacity and warehouse capacity. So those things are all pressures. Everything on this list is pushing logistics costs higher. Now, at some point, and I guess I'll take one step back, they measure aggregate capacity and aggregate price. The thing of note on this is that the aggregate price for everything, that's storage and transportation, is going up. And it's about 175% of where it was a year ago. Meanwhile, aggregate capacity has stayed steady. It's almost exactly where it was back in September of last year, and it's slightly lower than it was 2 years ago. So this is to say the price has, let's just call it, doubled. Capacity has stayed the same. And so what do we have? We've got a squeeze on logistics where there's a ton of demand, not a ton of supply. So we've got the price going up. Now, that aggregate capacity hasn't moved. It hasn't moved because it just takes a while to spin that kind of thing up. It takes a while to build new warehouses. It takes a while to build new containers. It takes a while to build all this stuff. That is in the works. How long it takes for that stuff to come online, I don't know. Your guess is probably as good as mine. But I don't think that stuff takes 5 years. I think that's more of a 12 to 24 month horizon.
I would agree with what you just said, Jake. In other industries, for example, in bulk freight, when you have a squeeze and you don't have enough providers, enough vessels, and the freight costs go higher, it takes 5-4 years in order to build new vessels and to balance supply and demand. In this case, many of the problems that we're seeing in supply chain are things that can be solved in less than 4 or 5 years. Building new containers, improving the logistics terminal, logistics and other stuff that are key to solve this problem can be solved easily, or at least in less than 4 years. So I think this type of problem should be coming to an end next year. And going back to what you were saying, Ted, at the beginning, as U.S. milk production continues growing, I think if the milk production continues going higher, the U.S. market is going to need to start exporting more product. And I would estimate that the plants are going to start being built more towards exports, making U.S. product more competitive abroad. So that's going to be a requirement, a required outlet for cheese production.
Let me come into this conundrum from a little different perspective. Is it fair to say that most of the exports that we have are bulk commodity dairy products? We export cheese, powder, whole milk powder in bulk. We don't really export, I don't believe, branded products as such to any great extent. I guess we do somewhat, but not to the extent that we import branded cheese products and butter products and so on from an assortment of different countries. So one of the effects of our CWT program is a legalized version of dumping, where it's not being done by the state necessarily, it's being done by private entities, because National Milk, who runs the CWT program, basically is in a position to affect market balancing by doing, in effect, a dumping program. Now, we don't have the brand that Fonterra has, for example, or some of the European cooperatives have, or proprietaries have. And maybe the disconnect that we're seeing here is to a large extent due to that. We're not really looking to export branded products or establish permanent markets in foreign countries. We're basically approaching the problem on a short-term basis by getting rid of skim milk solids and whole milk powder and bulk cheese and so on. Is that angle of attack worthy of note, or am I looking at it wrong?
I think a lot of what you said, Ted, is correct. But also, Fonterra, New Zealand, Europe, a lot of the exports, it's more of a balanced blend of exports between branded products, spec'd in products, even if they're bulk, and then sort of your more general bulk category. And the U.S. certainly on the powder space has tried to get into more of the spec'd in product, meaning that it's a multinational approved spec, and so that they come back and buy it quarter after quarter. But there's still a lot of, if you will, general bulk spec product that has to get moved as well.
I guess what I'm searching for in this whole thing is consistent business. We have on the grocery store shelf here in the U.S., we have products of European origin, which are continuously represented. Do we have our products in other countries, particularly Europe, any other country where our retail products are represented?
I would say we're not doing as good a job marketing branded U.S. dairy products into retail or restaurant entities internationally. Our commodity level brands, you know, ingredients that have a brand identity, if you will, we probably do a decent job with that. Companies like Dairy America probably being at the foremost because there's so much Dairy America powder exported worldwide. But there's other brands as well that carry some weight in the ingredient markets around the world. But I think you're right, Dad. I think Europe has done a much better job than the U.S. in marketing and selling internationally high value added dairy products. To me, the bigger question is, the Fonterra brand in the ingredient space still carries more weight than most American ingredient brands, dairy ingredient brands. The argument I would make that step one would be, how can we continue to cut into the Fonterra market share? And how can we get to the point where our dairy products are priced at a level equal, if not greater, for similar products than Fonterra? And that's where I get the feeling that we've failed a little bit.
even maybe the measure isn't higher than Fonterra on a price point, but more equal to Fonterra.
Mm-hmm. But I will also say that I think you need to have an honest discussion about whether it's Fonterra out of New Zealand or it's a couple of the really big European cooperatives like Friesland Campina or Arla, who have the ability to internally within their organizations subsidize their exports to a certain extent, but they also have built those brand identities in a way where those are the brands that the U.S. is competing against. And we have trouble competing with them. But I would say that in many cases, in all three of those companies, our biggest struggle, how do I put this? Price isn't the real issue. It's consistent supply. Our price tends to be so volatile in the U.S. that we aren't always competitive in the world marketplace. We tend to price ourselves in and out of the world marketplace in a way that makes it difficult for us to be successful.
Which I might point out goes back to Don's point that CWT is part of that problem.
Yes.
In that it distorts the marketplace price and probably in effect the price is more volatile rather than less, which then taking it one step further affects our ability to market branded products on grocery store shelves in other countries.
I agree. So here's the billion-dollar question for the U.S. dairy industry that I don't think anybody has an answer for. But how do you fix it? How do you put the U.S. dairy industry in a position to be competitive with those global players?
It's really difficult to play catch-up when you look at some of the Friesland companies, you know, that were around before internationally, before World War II, and certainly a lot of investment immediately after World War II. And good grief, you know, that was 75 years ago.
And Friesland Campina has international subsidiaries marketing local dairy products throughout Asia and Africa, correct?
Correct. And South America.
And South America. So one of their big advantages is they're marketing the companies they own and marketing through into the domestic marketplace of all of these countries through their own entities, something the U.S. doesn't really have.
Correct.
And we don't have any structure at this point to do that.
It's interesting. You know, I'm thinking of the U.S. dairy companies that are currently expanding internationally. And the two that quickly came to mind, they're big U.S. dairy companies, but they're actually not owned in the U.S. Their headquarters are in other countries. There's no U.S.-based country that's doing that.
And even there, Ted, if I'm thinking of the two companies that might be to the north of the U.S., part of that strategy is not marketing, it's production as well.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But Don, let me ask you this, and I don't know enough about what Friesland's Campina strategy was 75 years ago, but when they expanded into those markets, was it production-oriented as well, or was it purely market-driven?
That was market-driven. Those were clearly milk deficit countries, and they were filling retail demand need with imported solids and local manufacturing.
You know, I think we're asking ourselves an important question that we don't have a good answer for the U.S. dairy industry. But that on a certain level is what we're competing against when we're trying to increase our market share of global trade, whether it's Fonterra, Friesland Campina, some of the Canadian dairy companies, others, they've actually invested heavily in those foreign countries, which gives them better access than the U.S. does, and probably also ultimately gives them the opportunity to get better prices.
I need to point out that 30, 40 years ago, basically Kraft was leading the marketing effort for cheese in the United States and worldwide. And they're basically no longer with us. They're a minor factor in the market.
I put it this way, Dad, they're owned by a French company now.
Yeah, that maybe tells the story even more that we don't really have the ownership and proprietary factors in the industry today that would take those steps to set up shop and market products in foreign lands. I think what U.S. DEC is doing is certainly laudable and has been very beneficial for the U.S. dairy industry, but I don't think that they've been particularly successful in setting up retail distribution in various countries that they've been. Am I wrong? I don't think so. I think mostly it's been setting up mechanics for dealing in basically bulk commodities when they're available.
I will say this, Dad. In the U.S. defense, that's not their job. And they do invest marketing dollars in many of those countries to try and expand basically the Made in the USA brand, if you will. So there is a lot of investment in marketing and marketing support in those countries. But that is a very big difference between investing in the quote-unquote U.S. brand, Made in the USA brand, versus companies with a major presence in those foreign countries investing in a nationwide identification of that dairy brand. Think of Danon in the U.S., which is a French yogurt company that came to the U.S. to develop Danone in the U.S., Danon brand, you know, and now it's a well-known yogurt brand. I don't think there's any U.S. dairy companies that are doing that to the extent that many foreign dairy companies are doing. And when you think about it, you know, in terms of the big brands out of Europe, some of them are family-owned or publicly traded. Some of them are cooperatives. And so there are farmer-owned cooperatives. I can think of three right off the top of my head in Europe that have made major, major investments, whether it's in the U.S. or in Asia, or other parts of the world, to expand their global presence. And there are not really any U.S. dairy cooperatives that have made the same kind of international investment. I mean, Fonterra is a co-op. It's done the same thing, making an international investment. And yet there aren't any co-ops in the U.S. leading that charge. And of course, now we can circle back to the age-old argument that we tend to always default to, which is the federal order in the way it's structured may have something to do with that. But I think that's a key component of one of the things that's holding U.S. dairy exports back. And I think it's going to reach a critical point here in the next 5 years, because I think if we keep expanding our milk production, we're going to need to keep expanding our exports, especially as a percentage of total milk production. And I don't know if we're going to be able to do that at prices that dairy farmers in the U.S. would find acceptable.
The current structure doesn't support an international marketing environment. And I mean it this way. I don't think the federal order stands in the way of international marketing. I think that Capra-Volstead probably stands in the way more. 95% of our milk now is cooperative. And there's really nothing wrong with that, except that when it comes time to set up a marketing organization internationally, you go to a vote of the dairy farmers. And now they're looking at setting up costs and structure 5 or 10 years down the road. And what group of dairy farmers in the United States is going to embrace that kind of vision today?
Well, and especially when their alternative is to build a cheese plant or a powder plant that is, I'm not going to call it risk-free, but it is at a much lower level of risk than making an international investment. Because of the make allowances embedded within the class three price and the class four price, you can invest in a powder plant or a cheese plant and on a certain level be guaranteed a certain return. Whereas you do something in China or in Japan or you make up the country, that is an exponential higher level of risk. But I'm going to argue that the reason the Europeans have been successful is because ultimately they had no choice. They had no alternative that was any better. They didn't have a federal order system that was protecting them. They had more milk coming at them. They had the Common Agricultural Program that was on a certain level subsidizing milk supply and protecting prices. And they knew they had to find a home for their milk, and they knew they weren't going to find it in their backyard. So they were either going to have to tell dairy farmers to stop producing milk, or they were going to have to find a new home for that milk somewhere else in the world. They had no choice. And so that's why they made that leap of faith. I think the federal order system continues to give co-ops in the U.S. a safer alternative. I'm not going to call it a better alternative, but I'm going to say it's a safer alternative.
Look at the last big cheese plant in the U.S., in the Midwest. a second one in sort of the South Midwest announced and on the books. Those are not export position plants, are they?
No, they're not. And they're not manufacturing a retail product.
No, it's very much a bulk product for further processing, cut and wrap, shredding, final retail presentation.
Ted, I guess I'll ask, when we started all this, you'd ask what exports are going to do in the foreseeable future here. What do you think the export landscape looks like 5 years from now?
Unfortunately, I don't think it looks much different than it does today. I don't think we have the infrastructure in place to make a really successful leap into a better value-added presence internationally. We may be able to export more value-added whey derivatives, but other than that, we're still in a situation where the U.S. industry and the way that it is structured incentivizes us to make commodity dairy products that I should define as commodities in the U.S. market, rather than make investments in figuring out how to clear dairy products internationally. And I think that ultimately is what's holding the U.S. dairy industry back. And I don't think anybody is investing in a way that's going to shift that. And so that concerns me. And I am hoping that I start hearing more conversations from companies about how they can build manufacturing specifically for export. But as long as the U.S. pricing system to dairy farmers doesn't incentivize that, I struggle to see where it's going to happen. Does anybody have an opposing viewpoint?
On the assumption that in a post-COVID world, we're probably looking at a lower population growth rate, will that not ultimately force the industry to figure out how to do this? Because when demand domestically would grow 1.5%, 2% a year, that was sort of the bread and butter.
So what I'm going to argue, Don, is this, and I'm going to say this, and I'm going to hope I'm wrong. I think the way the U.S. dairy industry is structured, I think what we ultimately will incentivize is a reduction in milk production rather than an investment in dairy exports, because it's going to be an issue of price and only price.
I don't know whether I want to agree with that or not, but I would observe that structurally, we do have cooperatives in the United States that do a very good job of marketing. And I'll take the liberty of mentioning people like Tillamook and Cabot. And on fresh products, people like Prairie Farms, who are getting into more of hard products, hard cheeses. But these people are very minor entities in our industry. We're basically set an example for, 90%, 80% of the rest of the industry who are strictly enamored with producing industrial products for further processing. So the people that are going to have to go to the international market are the cooperatives that are producing retail products or proprietaries that are producing retail products. And those that are only producing bulk products for further processing are stuck where exactly Ted says they are. They're not going to go anywhere unless they succeed in giving away these products through subsidies into the international market, which in my view is strictly a stopgap solution. In the long term, I don't think that's going to play.
Don, Jake, Diego, hey, thanks a lot for joining us today. I thought that was really helpful. I thought this ended up being a really good discussion.
Glad to be a part of it. Thanks, Ted.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone.
We welcome your participation in the Milk Check. If you have comments to share or questions you want answered, send an email to podcast@jacobi.com. Our theme music is composed and performed by Phil Keggy. The Milk Check is a production of TC Jacobi & Company.